Are there folks who can't see either of, can't see the handouts? There are two single handouts.
Pass that back, please. Okay.
Welcome very much. Anyone else? You didn't get yours yet? Oh, you're passing them back. Okay.
There, Mark.
This is a session on asceticism and consumerism, which doesn't sound like much fun. But we're going to have some fun doing it. I think it was G.K. Chesterton who said, you can have all the sobriety you want in your neckties, but unless you have, when you talk about religion and your way of life, there better be mirth or you'll have madness. So we're going to have some mirth. I hand it over to Linda and Sophie.
Okay, this is a rant that I wrote not too long ago, and I started out thinking, because I have a lot of problems with like envy and desire in my life, you know, kind of like, oh, I want to go to South Africa and hang out with Alan Stewart like Tom and Mary did or whatever, you know. Tom and Mary live across the street, so you can understand. I see them getting in their car with their big, you know, suitcase, and I'm like, so anyway, it started out as that kind of thing, and then it started into this whole thing where, you know, desire, just an exploration of desire. I mean, you can also desire to be like a monk, you know, and I want to be like that person, and I want to have that, and so, and it might be, I hope it's not offensive to anybody, because it's pretty unchained. This is your part. This is number one, number two, and number three. This one goes like this. When we point to you with the number one, you sing, you say, I want it all, I want it now, I want it, want it, want it. I want it all.
Whoops, sorry.
Because I deserve it. Give it to me, give it. Got it? Okay, number two. I gotta have it all, I gotta have it now, I gotta. I need it all, I need it now, just give it to me, give it. And the last one. I want it all, I want it now, I want it, want it, want it. I'm gonna die if I don't get it. Charge it to me, charge it. There you go. All right. I want your eyes, your lips, your thighs. I want your face, your grace, your summer place, your fretless bass. I want your cool, your Olympic swimming pool. I want your sleek beauty and your bootylicious booty. I want your Steinway grand. I want your piece of land. I want your jeweled hand, famous band, your stand on human rights, steamy nights, your Swedish cotton tights, international flights. I want your SA delights. I want it all. I want it now. I want it, want it, want it. I want it all because I deserve it. Give it to me. Give it to me.
Shopping spree, kill a tree, don't look at me, your I don't care designer, hair Victoria's Secret underwear.
Want your Rolex, hot sex, foie gras, la-di-da, shih tzu, Jimmy Choo, rooftop panoramic view. I want it all, I want it now, I want it, want it, want it. I want it all because I deserve it, give it to me. I want your cabin on a lake, Lutherans. I want your cabin on a lake, your flowerless chocolate cake, your insouciant slouch. I want your leather couch.
I want your thousand thread count Egyptian cotton sheets. I want your first edition gilt edge leather bound keys.
I gotta have it all. I gotta have it now. I gotta. I need it all. I need it now.
Give it to me.
I want your low fat yoga mat, feng shui, hoka hay, sweat lodge, full massage, goat fromage, entourage.
You're letting go with the flow. Silk, pajama, Dalai Lama, meditation, spa vacation, relaxation,
I want your little black dress, your lack of stress, your unpretentiousness, your attitude, your discipline, your dewy, well-hydrated skin.
Your dead sea, PhD, spotless house, adoring spouse, trained dog, daily jog.
I want your Harley Hog. I want it all, I want it now, I want it, want it, want it. I want it all because I deserve it, give it to me. I want your cold shower,
willpower, 60-hour office tower, shoe shine, fine wine, bloodline, dollar sign.
Your drip dry alibi, high stakes overtake.
Prostitute, Armani suit, I want your golden parachute. I want it all, I want it now, I want it, want it, want it. I want it all because I deserve it, give it to me, give it. Guatemala, Buddha, Allah, dreadlock, out of a rock, stop it, man, and save the planet.
Vegan, pagan, Copenhagen, less is more.
Make out, not war. I want your tattoos, free booze, nothing to lose, narcotic snooze. Wild thing, nipple ring, syringe sting, smoke ring, your skepticism.
Cynicism.
Atheism.
Anarchism.
Nihilism.
Nihilism.
Narcissism.
Jingoism.
Spasm, schism, chismism. I want it all,
I want it now, I want it, want it, want it. I want it all because I deserve it, give it to me, give it.
Dark tan, boogie board, wild man, fast food, mellow mood, home brewed, yo, dude. I want you, thank you, Jesus, saves and freezes, hot dish and Velveeta cheeses.
True believer, pain reliever, good behavior, Lord and Savior.
Blue sky, apple pie.
Big flag, Gucci bag.
Win the war.
Seal the deal.
Global warming isn't real. I want it all, I want it now, I want it, want it, want it.
I want it all because I deserve it, give it to me, give it.
I want it all, I want it now,
I want it, want it, want it. I'm gonna die if I don't get it, charge it to me, charge it.
I want to be Joseph and Naomi Campbell.
Thich Nhat and Goldie Hawn.
Warren and Jimmy Buffett.
Madeline and
Genghis
Khan.
I want to be Michael Phelps, Uma Thurman, Joan of Arc, and Ethel Merman. I want it all, I want it now, I want it, want it, want it.
Barbie, Furby, Lassie, Herbie.
Paul, Clay, Man, Ray.
JFK,
and Tina Fey.
I want it all, I want it now, I want it, want it, want it. I want it all, if I don't get it, charge it to me, charge it.
I want it, oh, oh, 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 I want it. Oh, oh, I want it.
Thanks, Sophie and Linda. I'll figure out a way to get them back tomorrow. incidentally, there's a documentary tonight called Tapped, which is about water as a commodity. And tomorrow when we do the sacred and the commodified, I'm going to use water as an example. So if some of you do see that, there'll be some carryover. You don't need to see it in order to be a part of the session tomorrow, but if there is a connection. This week is the week when we're going to spend on what I'm simply calling Earth Honoring Faith. And it has its own premise. The premise is that planetary health is primary and human well-being is derivative. Doesn't mean human well-being is secondary, it's derivative of planetary health. You don't have the health of the human community and its members if you have a degraded planet and aren't attending to what the claims of the parental generative elements, the primal elements, make of us. So if we don't attend to the moral claims of Earth, soil, air, breath, water, fire, energy, we can't have human well-being, especially when we're 7 billion and counting on an already diminished planet. When human society is large and the rest of nature is vulnerable, in contrast to what your ancestors and mine faced when nature was large and human society was small, and vulnerable. We flipped that. So, it calls for religious ethics, including Christian ethics, in a new key. The key is centering those generative elements for the whole community of life, centering them in the life of faith, so that human justice must also now be creation justice. And we've got to get rid of this profound dualism of humanity and nature. It doesn't work. This week, I want to talk about the deep religious traditions, the shared ecumenically interreligious traditions that might be resources, if they are earth-honoring or might become earth-honoring, resources to address a diminished planet, resources for planetary health. I've just got three questions for today. Is there an alternative to consumerism other than individual lifestyle changes? We've got to change the light bulbs. I know that. We've got to do the recycling. We've got to drive our Prius to Home Depot. I know that. but that won't do it. When you got to the end of Al Gore's important movie, An Inconvenient Truth, and you waited for What Ought We to Do, here is the Vice President of the United States, formerly, without a single solitary policy proposal or talk of justice. It was all a list of individual lifestyle changes you can make. It doesn't do it. We've got to screw in alternative light bulbs, but we've got to find a different global treaty as well. Addition doesn't count as much as multiplication. So is there an alternative other than individual lifestyle changes? What might it be? Another way to ask much the same question is, can global corporate capitalism be truly ecologized? If that's the global human economy and it is out of sync with the economy upon which it depends totally, the economy of nature, then you've got to find a way to wholly ecologize capitalism. If that can't be done, then we've got to have something else, because we'll run ourselves into the ground, and the ground will be losing topsoil in the process. Or, the question for this session, can we be truly human now without asceticism? Asceticism is a word for religious traditions across the board. I mean, Hindus and Buddhists are, and Christian asceticism is a kind of junior tradition compared with the asceticism of a number of other religious traditions. And we can call it traditions of the simple life. That's probably the way in which we've talked about it. I will get later, when we talk about some of the elements of asceticism, to factors which say more than what we usually associate with the simple life. So I'm not making them simple synonyms. Okay, an important distinction before we go any further. We're all consumers, and we have to be consumers. There isn't any life form that doesn't consume. The amoeba were those little flagellate looking for decaying food molecules to consume them. Life cannot exist apart from consuming. So consumption is not what I mean by consumerism. We'll all go to lunch today. We can get by, you know, and we can fast, and that's a good thing for a while. Can't fast too long. At some point or another, you need to renew your energies by consuming. Consumerism, however, is a way of life. That's a different matter. That's consumerism as, I think, kind of the phantom cosmology of our time. Source of our values, source of our outlook. Our way of life is a life of consumerism, and anytime you see ism, you're probably talking about a way of life. So, an important distinction between consumption, and consumerism. Now, thousands of us know the opening line of Wordsworth's sonnet, "The World is Too Much With Us." But most of us have forgotten what follows that. The world is too much with us. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. This sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours, and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers, for this, for everything, we are out of tune. It moves us not. The getting and spending has resulted in a life that doesn't hear, listen to the rest of nature. And the rest of nature moves us not. Has getting and spending, consumerism, I want it all, charge it, so laid waste our powers, sent our hearts packing, and alienated our souls that we no longer belong to nature and see ourselves in it as part of it? Has commodification so deadened the living world, so leached away the sacred, that even plaintive winds and open seas don't wash our spirits and move us to mystery and to wonder? Are we this bereft? Are we this out of tune? Are we this unmoved? Well, Wordsworth himself thought so, and he chose a conspicuous departure from Christianity as the way back, or for him, the way forward. Great God, he goes on, I'd rather be a pagan, suckled in the creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. So Wordsworth's preference was for a pagan creed outworn. Might there be, for those of us not quite ready to go there, a Christian asceticism that would find us tuned to the rest of nature, and not trapped in getting and spending and charging it? Let me tell you a little bit about the history of asceticism here. I mean, well, that too, but consumerism first. How did we come to this place? How did this global phenomenon of mass affluence come to be? We know the history, some of the history on this. It's a history of conquest, colonization, and commerce, and Christianity all wrapped together in a package called civilization, bringing that to the rest of the world. more needs to be said about this kind of phantom cosmology that undergirds this kind of driving social psychological efforts to have it all. The stage was set most recently by the Depression. The sacrifices of the war years after that, World War I and World War II in particular, and then after World War II, the return home of thousands of troops, all in their working years, all ready to get started, having families, settle down, and the need to rebuild Europe and Asia after history's most destructive war. This compelled a response that was anticipated by the Roosevelt administration. New Dealer Robert Nathan, one of the key people in Roosevelt's administration, put together a plan called Mobilizing for Abundance. He did that in 1944. A couple of years later, the former head of the wartime Office of Price Administration, an important office, his name was Chester Bowles, offered a plan, Tomorrow Without Fear. Both were programmatic works, and both argued for consumerism as the successor to the wartime mobilization of the economy. So it was a very practical response to conditions of the end of the war and all of the working class that needed jobs and nations that needed rebuilding. Roosevelt himself put a key element in place only months before his death. Aboard a warship in the Red Sea, outfitted like a desert oasis, complete with a small herd of sheep, Roosevelt cut a deal with the House of Saud, of Saudi Arabia. A deal in which the United States pledged support for the House of Saud, even Saud, as the rulers of Saudi Arabia and his family, a deal that exchanged that support for a guarantee of an unlimited flow of oil and oil profits. And as we will soon see when we look at a handout, there isn't any way in the world that what has happened since 1950 could have happened other than with stored energy in the form of fossil fuels. But energy agreements and programmatic ideas don't go anywhere without enabling legislation. And Harry Truman's signature to the Employment Act of 1946 put these programs into play. The propensity to consume, in quotation marks, is the explicit language of the act. Still, even federal policy of itself would not suffice. A world economy was in view already, and it needed new institutions for the post-war world. In July 1944, world leaders gathered for just that purpose in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. United States Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, presided, and in his opening speech, he laid out the infinite growth assumption of global consumerism. All peoples of the world were to enjoy, quote, the fruits of material progress on an earth infinitely blessed with natural resources, end of quotation. They need only embrace, quote, the elementary economic axiom that prosperity has no fixed limits. It is not a finite substance to be diminished by division, end of quotation. So the Bretton Woods institutions put in place that basic assumption that we still live with, that we can have infinite economic growth. Let me read you the statement of one who President Obama chose as his chief economic advisor, Larry Summers, Secretary of the Treasury under President Clinton, and before that, the head economist of the Bretton Woods Institution, the World Bank, president of Harvard University as well, quoting Larry Summers, "There are no limits to the carrying capacities of the earth that are likely to bind any time in the foreseeable future. There isn't a risk of an apocalypse due to global warming or anything else. The idea that we should put limits on growth because of some natural limit is a profound error." End of quotation. Nyla will tell you, when President Obama appointed Larry Summers and Tim Geithner as his chief advisor, I said, that's it for any resolution of the great collision between the human economy and the economy of the rest of nature. You can't get it. You can talk all you wish about green energy, but so long as you maintain an axiom of infinite economic growth, on a system that pushes for short-term results and the bottom line, you won't get the merging of the human economy with the economy upon which it's dependent. Okay, the last thing on this that was really important for this post-war economic growth, and that was all of these sectors, business, government, the general public, found their Bible in W.W. Rostow's The Stages of Economic Growth, a non-communist manifesto. That was published in 1953, and what Rostow did was place all societies everywhere in the world on one or another of five stages of economic growth: the traditional society, the preconditions for takeoff, the drive to maturity, and the culmination, the age of high mass consumption. That last one is the mature economy. That's the phrase for an economy of high mass consumption. Incidentally, the progression from one stage to the next borrowed a key term from biology and from nature's unfolding and applied it with a new meaning to the political economy. And that phrase was development. It was taken from biology. But what I want to emphasize is that the telos, the goal of the whole economic enterprise is to arrive at a mature economy as an economy of high mass consumption. Okay, all of this getting and spending was to redound to the common good and for a whole lot of human beings. It has indeed generated enormous benefits. That's why you and I, many of us are here, why we're living longer, why our range of choice in our lifetimes is greater than than many of our ancestors experienced. So this succeeded in a terrifically important way of generating a good that could be shared widely. It also generated mass poverty in the process, but it generated a widely shared wealth. Now, if you will take a look at the handout that has the graph on it, and I don't want to spend a whole lot more time with this because I want to get to a discussion of these three questions. But if you look at page 56, and talking about being consumers, you should all buy this book called Earth Honoring Faith, Religious Ethics in a New Key, which will be out from Oxford in October. And so don't forget that. Well, you can
charge.
And do it before you die. All right. Buy it, share, send it around, share it. One copy will go a long way, really. Okay. Now, these graphs are put together by a group of scientists tracking global trends, a group of scientists called the International Geosphere Biosphere Program. And what you should notice are the drivers, which are the top two, in top row, left to right, the first two, population and total gross domestic product, or we should say gross international product now, because it's unprecedented human population carrying out unprecedented economic activity that produces everything else in all of these graphs. Those are the drivers. The population flipped from the beginning. It took all of human history to get to 1.6 billion people by 1900. By 2000, the number was 6.1. And 2000, when did 2010? We passed 7 billion, right? So that is an enormous hockey stick escalation there.
But notice that the same is true for economic activity made possible by fossil fuels. And you can ask yourself, what in the world does direct foreign investment, the damming of rivers, water use, fertilizer consumption, increase in paper consumption have to do with so many more McDonald's restaurants? You know? Or motor vehicles, telephones, and international tourism? The same screeching acceleration is present on all of these graphs. Okay, that's a combination of our numbers. You can't easily talk about population policy these days, but that's a combination of population and economic activity. Flip over to the other side. Same book that you should buy. All right. And see what the consequences are for the economy of nature. The top three, left to right, are greenhouse gases. The next one is ozone depletion. Notice the screeching acceleration again. Surface temperature, making a similar climb. Occurrence, and some places recurrence of great floods. Was it 2010 when 1/5 of Pakistan was underwater? Ozone ecosystems and their exploitations. Most of the great fisheries are now fully exploited. A number of them have collapsed. The oceans are losing ecosystems faster than the rainforest. And the acidification of the oceans is happening faster than it has in any time during human history. Likewise, you continue going, changes in coastal zone structures, changes in coastal zone biochemistry, loss of tropical rainforest, topsoil, and global diversity. We're in probably in the sixth great period of species extinction. We haven't been around as a species ourselves for the first five, but the sixth one is in part due to the press of human habitat against the rest of habitat, or creating a toxic habitat, even where humans aren't. Okay, so that's the consequences of this way of life, global consumerism. Not all human beings, of course, are located in the same place. A whole lot of people have to have more in order to be more, or in order to address poverty. There needs to be an increase in vital goods in a lot of sectors, but there's a disproportionate use in other sectors, such that it's destructive, and also in many cases works in such a way that it's generative of poverty. I don't think we need to take further examples. I just want to raise a question raised by conservative pundit George Will. Putting scarcity behind us has been pleasant, but has it been good for us? Meaning, good for our souls. Has this been good for our souls? Are we better as human beings and as a species because of it? Well before George Will, and we cited G.K. Chesterton at the outset, others have answered with an emphatic no. G.K. Chesterton paid Times Square a visit in 1922, and he observed not only serious hedonism, but something else. All the colors and fires of that place, the lights, were being attached to an endless flow of commodities. Light and fire, previously linked to powerful sacred meanings, were now part of the new illumination of mass advertising. And that was in 1922. Go to Times Square today. H.L. Mencken's Chesterton concluded, "This sacred illumination has made people weary of proclaiming great things by perpetually using it to proclaim small things."
H.L. Mencken's version, typical of his populist cynicism, says, beneath all that false tinsel, there's real tinsel. That's a life of taking, carefully built upon the cultivated desire for small things. And my fear is that we can't distinguish between the small things and the great things anymore. Or we take the small things to be the great things. Yeah. Well, last point here. And this is where I feel we're really trapped, and I need to go to Bible study the rest of the week. This is no longer a matter of materialism and acquisitiveness as something some citizens might choose as choices. This is no longer a motive of avarice and greed on the part of most people. This is institutionalized spirituality and morality, with economic globalization now the most universal of faiths. Avarice and greed are not then left to the insensitive few. They're the structural needs for the economy. We're trying like the Dickens to get that economy on those sheets back on track. It actually hasn't left the track. It's still continuing in the same directions. But that's what we're working at. We don't know how to do it. How do we get jobs? So we've made all this avarice and greed not a matter of motive. It may or may not be. But it's a structural necessity of the economy, the mature economy. Thus, persons who are not greedy by disposition share a lot way of life with those who are. They fly the same planes, drive the same cars, need the same infrastructure, share the same diet, attain the same degree, work the same jobs, live in the same housing development, send the kids to the same school, try their best to get the economy back on track, overuse the same soil and water, and lift the same emissions into the atmosphere. You know who saw this in 1904? Max Weber. He saw this captivity coming, a disenchanted world. He calls this world that's been leached of the sacred and the mysterious by commodification. He called this world a disenchanted or utterly secular world, fired by, quote, economic compulsion, that is detached from, quote, the highest spiritual and cultural values. This compulsion in turn creates, I'm quoting Weber, specialists without spirit, as well as sensualists without heart, who imagine this nullity to be the highest level of civilization ever attained. Moreover, he said, in the field of its highest development, the United States, the pursuit of wealth, stripped of its religious and ethical meaning, tends to become associated with purely mundane passions, which often give it the character of sport. So one plays the stock market, for example, or bets on this or that investment. Then democracy becomes the liberty to acquire wealth and use it as one wishes in the ownership society, rather than a system of government used as an equalizing force for the common good and the democratizing of economic, political, and social power. Weber finishes by saying, he calls this an iron cage, which we built around ourselves. Bound to the technical and economic conditions of machine production and the tremendous cosmos of the modern economic order, life in this cage determines the lives of all the individuals who are born into it with irresistible force. And then listen to his sentence. 19:4. Quote, perhaps it will so determine them until the last ton of fossilized coal is burned. Okay. All right. So you've got consumerism as soul craft, and you've got consumerism as institutional necessity of the economy. Is there an alternative to that? Is there an alternative to that? That isn't simply you and I deciding to buy some red worms and start our compost pile. I hope you all will. That is important. You've got to have those kinds of actions so as to show the way. But it has to be something more systemic than that and pervasive of our institutional life and not just this narrow range of individual choices, take them or leave them. Or can global corporate capitalism be ecologized? I'll just finish and then we'll discuss with Father John Chrysagoras' little outline of ascetic ethics. Asceticism is this deep religious tradition that's been around for centuries, breaks out every now and again, speaks to something in the human spirit, is cross-cultural, is pan-religious. So there's something there that's going on. Let me just finish with Father John Chrysagoras' summary.
I would say his name again.
Chrysagoras. I can say it. I don't know if I can do any more with it. Let me spell it. A wonderful little book. I think it's called The Shattered Image, where he talks about the world as a sacrament. He's an Orthodox priest. He writes, you have the ecumenical, you have the green ecumenical patriarch, Bartholomew, at all expeditions of the seas, and so I'm trying to rally asceticism, sacramentalism, and mysticism for a different understanding of earth and protection and restoration of earth. John Chrysagoras is the ecumenical patriarch's ghostwriter. I would define asceticism as traveling light. We can always manage with less than we imagine. Letting go. We are to learn to relinquish our desire to control. Opening up. We are called to create bonds, to reunite, to reconcile. Softening up. How can we make our communities less savage, more inhabitable? Treading light. We must not hurt. We must stop wounding our environment. Living simply, not complicating our relationship with each other and with our environment, consuming less, and simply living. Not competing against each other and against nature in order to survive. Asceticism aims at refinement, not detachment. Its goal is moderation, not repression. Its content is positive, not negative. It looks to service, not selfishness, to reconciliation, not renunciation or escape. Without asceticism, none of us is authentically human. And my question is, given an economy that on balance is destructive of the planetary health upon which we depend, can we be human now without asceticism? The wonderful letter from the Jewish rabbis, wonder and restraint as the call to our times, to find again ourselves as creatures of wonder, who wonder, at the singular privilege of life that this planet offers. And at the same time, the first generation that may have to, as a generation, practice restraint. It isn't that restraint hasn't been in order, especially in some sectors, classes of society. It's that it hasn't been a necessity when the human society is relatively small and the rest of nature large. But when it's the other way around, and the vulnerability then is restraint, a necessity. Okay, who's answering the first question? Is there an alternative to consumerism? Beyond life sense. I mean, the answer in some sense is easy. There have been lots of ascetic communities, you know, so which haven't been individual, they've been communities. Paul?
Well, when you were developing your argument for institutionalized spirituality and the necessity of this unlimited consumption, the language that was ringing in my head was language of addiction.
Addiction, yes.
And, you know, there was a teacher a couple weeks ago who defined addiction as given over to in advance.
Uh-huh.
And the way
given over to an advance, yeah.
The way okay. the structure gives us over, corporately gives us over to that in advance. But it is a helpful category because there's alternative to addiction. And we would call that freedom.
Yeah.
Or sanity or sobriety, I mean a number of terms.
Yeah. But you have to recognize.
You have to recognize it, right.
Yeah. You have to recognize that you are
and you have to climb on
or that you're addicted. Incidentally, ecumenical patriarch Bartholomew talks in that language about our use of nature. He says, he uses the analogy of abuse and the abuser. The abuser is one who does not abide by limits or boundaries. The abuser lacks respect for those boundaries and for the autonomy of his or her victim. Instead, he or she feels somehow entitled to do what he or she desires to the other. Our treatment since the 1750 of the rest of nature, especially in what Weber calls a disenchanting of the world less and less communicative of its mystery and sacredness, and wonder to us, it moves us not, to remember Wordsworth. Our ethic has been an utterly utilitarian one. How might we use nature? In its crassest forms, it's what can we get away with as we use it? I'm going to use harsh language. This is a continuation of the oldest human ethic, the master-slave ethic. And we're the masters, and the rest of nature is slave to us. Masters are to be good stewards. And I remind you that a good white Christian slaveholder was to be a good steward, as a Christian, of his slave. But this is stewardship in which the master decides what the place and use of the slave is. You always need slaves, can't get along without them. But some slaves can be replaced by other slaves. That's an utterly utilitarian ethic, because all of the decisions about the well-being of the other rest in the hand of the master. So we've gotten rid of not all slavery by any means. There's a lot of sexual slavery still around. But the place where it is an ethic full-blown is the relationship of the global economy to the economy of nature. Yeah.
I'm sure you know this, but the country of Bhutan has replaced the gross national product with gross national happiness.
Yeah, the gross national happiness, and they've got a set of measures. What is it that really fulfills human nature? Yeah, I want a gross national happiness.
But they're very serious. I mean, we were speaking at some of the conference in Madison this last spring, and very serious.
So. Yeah, yeah. And there's a very interesting set. There's a very interesting literature on happiness. Mm-hmm. Now, we could talk about that one of these days. Mm-hmm. What it is that makes people happiness, and what they found in a whole lot of sociological studies about happiness. But I think Bhutan may be the only country that's seeking to sort of measure this and making a national policy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
I think of the most everyone here, we've come through the Judeo-Christian lifestyle, whatever. But we've all been told that God gave us dominion.
Yeah.
And this is misappropriated dominion, which is the same as domination. We've got the right to domination.
Yeah.
Reverse that.
Yeah. We need another Bible study. Yeah. I like John. I like Douglas John Hall's treatment of that. Christians also claim Jesus is Dominus. Jesus is Lord. So, exercise dominion in the way Jesus does. That's one possible take. Now, in the Hebrew, you've got two things going in those two different creation stories. Tilling and keeping is the other. And that's because we're soil creatures. And we're put here to cultivate the soil.
So we should live like red worms.
Well, we should take seriously the life of red worms as we live here. Yeah.
Yes.
John, you ever said that we would continue to abuse nature as long as we view it as a commodity.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't change until we saw it as a community of which we are a part.
Yeah.
So unless we can make that mass transition.
Yeah. That's Thomas Berry puts it this way. He says that the universe is not a collection of objects, it's a communion of subjects. Yeah, Jen.
Well, I think one of the mindset changes that we have to have goes back to, we have to critique our economic assumptions, like this infinite growth model that's like the water that mainstream economists just swim in, and every economics class and every economics textbook and every newspaper and every magazine and every our discourse of economics doesn't even mention that this is one perspective. Like they just talk about it like that is economics, that is the reality. And there are other economists and they're so marginalized, but for people who are interested, I mean Herman Daly, Marilyn Waring, and ecological economists and ecological economics, and it's very different from environmental economists. Environmental economists only want to put a monetary value on how much is that forest worth, how much is the tree worth,
the services,
how much clean air worth, and count it into the spreadsheets.
Yeah.
But ecological economists recognize the limits, and that we have this finite system, and that an economy has to work within the ecological system as a subset of the world.
Yeah.
And I would just also mention that, I mean, one thing I would like to do is demand, for example, NPR, along with whether the Dow Jones goes up or down every day, to also report our, there are other measures besides the Bhutan's national happiness, a thing called the National Progress Indicator, or like in Minnesota, they have the Minnesota Progress Indicator, a city can do it, the Seattle Progress Indicator, and it measures not just employment and this and that, but it measures air quality, water quality, infant health, education, literacy levels, all this kind of, so Dow Jones went up, our national progress indicator went down.
Right.
Would that ever get people thought, well, what's that?
Yeah.
Oh, we've got sales of home security systems and guns went up, but GNP went, it would start to cause questions. And people are like, is this economic model the one that we want to work with?
Yeah. One person says, the more we turn nature into dead things, the GNP, the GNP rises. But I want to tell you a little story since you mentioned Herman Daly. And a lot of what you're talking about is happening. There are lots of states and cities and places that are trying to say, wealth isn't measured only by economic wealth. There's biological wealth, there's cultural wealth, there's health. as wealth and so on. And it's really heartening to see that there's a lot of this going on. Just as there are a lot of communities that wouldn't call themselves ascetic communities, but who are working, you know, with wonder and restraint as their key values. There's a whole movement now called transition towns, where towns that started in the UK are trying to work out as a local economy an alternative to the global economy and their dependence upon it. But I have to tell you a story about Herman Daler, who's a saint here in the field of ecological economics. He worked for Larry Summers when Larry Summers was the head of the World Bank. And they were both economists. And Summers was a head economist, and Herman Daler was working in the World Bank, hoping that he could make some headway for ecological economics. And a memo came around from Larry Summers diagramming the economy. And it was a square box, and it had a number of arrows going in a number of different directions inside the box to show the dynamics of the world economy. Herman Daler drew a circle around the box and labeled it the economy of nature to indicate where the box was located. He got his amended diagram back from Larry Summers, who simply wrote, "This is not the way we think about the economy." And he was right.
This is a different direction. It seems to me like I want to challenge the churches and Lutherans to. It seems like when I was more of a Lutheran activist, you know, 10 years ago maybe, there was that feeling of, you know, it's going to be hard, but we have to give things up because otherwise, you know, the world's going to go to hell in a handbasket, and there's a lot of fear, and, you know, what does that mean? I can't have my boat, you know, whatever. But it wasn't until I realized that I thought there was too much talking and not enough listening and not enough silence, not enough prayer, but just, and even the prayer was just talking, and that's when I went and found insight meditation, and that's where I learned that it's not giving up, it's freedom. You know, honest to God, it's freedom, and now it seems like a really, I mean, that's it feels like every time I let go of something, I feel freer, you know, so it's not like, oh, yeah, it's going to be hard, but we can do it, you know, but we're, you know, then our kids aren't going to have what we had, but really, it's just like, you know, just shut up and sit in a forest and you'll realize, or just, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, and that whole thing about, you know, walking on the ground without your shoes, you know, like Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, walking meditation.
Moses.
Like, let it go and you'll realize you're much happier.
Yeah.
It's just that, to me, that was just this whole shift that I think the church hasn't gotten yet. I mean, on some people in the church have gotten it, but as a whole, it's like we don't get, like, if you're interested in, just Google the word minimalist, and there's a whole movement out there. There's blogs, there's one called Miss Minimalist, which is amazing, which is about all about the freedom that you can get from letting go of so many things. And it's just like the joy is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, now it just feels like, oh God, now I have to, like, there's all this crap in order to...
No, I think there's the first question you run into is kind of a fear of falling, fear of what I have to give up, and so on. And individuals can make these transitions, but the best way to do it is with some fun in community.
Right, totally.
I can tell you lots of stories, because we were part of a community in Washington, D.C. that had something to do with the whole village, Community of Christ. The things we, for example, we had a progressive fast. So we walked to different people's houses, and we walked to John and Mary Schramm's for the non-appetizer.
Then we went somebody else's place for the non-entree. You know, and we just walked around the neighborhood, had the best time. Didn't need a thing. So you should do a progressive fast. Have some. You know, enjoy. But I'm just saying, doing that together with other people. We decided to get rid of cars. A few of us got together and said, well, we certainly don't need one car per family, so let's get rid of some, and commit ourselves to public transportation. But we did still have three cars, and so we had keys, and we lived in, this is inner city Washington, D.C., where there weren't garages, so you just walked around the neighborhood until you found a car that your key fit in. So we weren't sure where our car was because you didn't know who drove it last and where it would be parked. One time the VW Golf had been stolen and had been gone for 3 days before we knew. And then you have to explain to the police about this. They think you live in a cult. Should be. Anyway, do it together. And the simplicity thing is much the same. We had a wonderful sabbatical. And we came home and we carried everything we had for a year in three suitcases. We got back home to our house in Washington, D.C., and you know, for the next 3 weeks, we wore the same clothes as we had all year because they had become good friends. It was so much simpler. Why do that? Why not do that instead of, you know, walk into the closet and try to figure out which shirt?
Well, and how many can we bring a millionth of what we own to the village, and then we don't even use it all? You know, yeah. You come home and you go, oh my God, I should have bought. Yeah.
We're gonna call this to a close. I want you to look around and observe the dynamics at Holden, and ask if there are any clues there. What's the economy of this place? Now, much of it still depends upon the global market. You got to bring a lot of food up the river, although we're growing some. And you know, what's the sense of equality and inequality around here? How, if there's a happiness index, how are we faring on the happiness index around here? At the same time, of taking extremely seriously the conflicts and issues of the world, so that we're not a separated community, but a renewing and renewable, sustainable community. Thank you for your time.